Welcome back to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. It's a Sunday morning in the fall in Salt Lake City. We have a high in Salt Lake right now. Temperatures just to that stage when you don't know if you want a sweatshirt or you do. I'm just heading out to go on a walk. I came in, put on a sweatshirt, went out again, and the weather or the temperature had risen to the point where I thought, well, I don't want to wear a sweatshirt. It's going to be too hot. So I thought I'd do a podcast, go on a walk, a long walk today, I think. I've been sitting at a desk way too much this week. Not as much as most people, but still too much for my tastes. I apologize for the quality of the audio on the last episode.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you, sir.
Good seeing you.
Thank you.
Just walking by my neighbor there. Anyway, I was on my way back up to the summer home. Had a couple repairs I needed to do. Main repair was crossing the street. My neighbor almost ran me down. All right. When I built this summer home, I was in my early 20s, and I thought I was really clever and smart, and decided I was going to design it myself, and I did, and it's a lousy design, but it's what I have to live with. I built it myself. It took about 5 years to build it. I was building the sailboat at the same time, but one of the mistakes I made when building this house was I went with radiant heat, which, as you know, is a very efficient heating source. Insulated it well, went with radiant heat. It's quiet, it's clean, it's efficient. The only trouble is we don't live there year-round. And on the few times that we do go up in the middle of the winter, it's usually at the nighttime, below zero, and the house is very cold. And with radiant heat, it takes 2 or 3 days to actually bring the house up to temperature. We'll probably be building an addition on the house in the next year or so. On the addition, I'm going to use forced air heating. The advantage of forced air is it's quick, but it's not anywhere near as efficient. It's more noisy and it's dirtier. But for when I go up in the winter and I want to use a house just for the day, it'll heat the house up quickly. And on the other part of the house, the old part of the house, we'll still have radiant heat, which will work its way through the house if we ever decide to live up there full time. Which I doubt if we will. It's beautiful, absolutely gorgeous in the summer, spring and the fall. But the winters, we're between two mountains. We're in the valley between two mountains, and the mountains run north and south. And so we don't get much sunlight during the day in the winters. Sun doesn't come up till probably around 10 in the morning and goes down probably at 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, and it's cold. It's cold, but it's still beautiful in the winter, but just the days are short. And I've found as time goes on, I like sunlight. I enjoy sunlight. In fact, as time goes on, I've been skiing my entire life. I used to live to ski. Now I wouldn't mind actually hopping to a warmer climate in the winter. And really for the sun as much as anything in Salt Lake in the winters. We get these inversions, which are just nasty, nasty inversions. It's caused by the high. We're in a basin, and the nasty, gunky air stays down in the valley, and it's beautiful, clear, and warmer up in the mountains. Well, anyway, I was on my way up there, and the radiant heat, it's been, at least 30 years since I built this house. And over the years, little by little, some of the coolant that was in the heating system, in the hot water heating system, would evaporate, and I had to keep adding a little more fresh water. I've got a hose hooked up to a faucet, so I would add a little more water as time went on. And I got worried that I thought, well, we might have lost enough coolant that I need to put some new coolant in. So that's what I did week before last. On my way up there, I was driving my old pickup truck, and there was a lot of background noise, so I apologize for that background noise. When I listened to it, I debated on throwing it out, but I thought, well, if anybody listens to it, fine. If not, that's fine too. But I do like a higher quality audio. Today, I'm going on a walk. I'm talking in a lavalier microphone. You'll have some background noise, but it's not going to be as bad as the last podcast. I'm a stickler for audio quality. On my regular podcasts, I do it from my office, and I'm not moving around, and the quality's better. I have a better microphone. But if you're listening to this, I guess you're willing to put up with the poor audio quality. Another thing I had to do was I had to go up and pick up the quarters of my elk that I shot that had been aging for about a week up there. So I had to bring them down, and that's the reason I took the truck up, is because my car wouldn't have been able to hold all the quarters without making a mess. So that's why I took the truck up. Spent a week, well, not a week. I spent two solid days butchering the elk once I got it back. It's something I wanted to do. I wanted to take it all away from the kill, all the way to the freezer. I had to buy a new freezer to keep all the meat. We are protein rich in our family right now. In fact, I went up the other day and there were some Duffy grouse flying around the summer home, and I decided I didn't even want to shoot them. Leave them for next year. We're leaving for other hunters. Of course, it's a private valley, so I'll just leave them for next year. Okay, had some really, really nice letters from some of you guys out there. I'm going to share them with you. I'm just coming over to a place where I can sit down and read them. I actually brought notes with me this time, so I could walk and talk and refer to my notes. Otherwise, I'm sort of stuck at a desk reading these. But it's a beautiful day. We're starting to get a little bit of the inversion right now. We've got a high rolling around Utah. And as I look south towards Point of the Mountain in Provo, I can see the haze building up in the valley, the start of an inversion. That's what happens when we have highs that sit over the valley. The mountains would be crystal clear and beautiful, but the valleys are sometimes good, sometimes bad. Sometimes it's just absolutely gorgeous. You can look out west and see for hundreds of miles, but not today. Now, by the way, I went out to the Bonneville Salt Flats while they were doing Speed Week in Utah. It's the first time in my life I've been out there. My daughter and I went out there. It was really interesting. It's really a surreal environment out there. You see a lot of automobile ads that are shot out there. Almost every major automobile company has shot several ads out on the Bonneville Salt Flats. But it's kind of fun. You go out there, everybody's lined up. They have a short track and a long track. And you walk along and people are just waiting to do their time trials. It's random. You know, you can have the 500 mile an hour car right next to a 200 mile an hour car next to a motorcycle. And it was fun. You just walk along and talk to the racers. They're passionate about what they do. They're excited about what they do. They want to talk to people, and they're just sitting there waiting for their turn, so they're more than willing to talk to people. I really enjoyed it, and I'll go out again next year. Running out of breath a little bit. Have to slow down. Okay. I'm sitting here, the overlook into City Creek Canyon. Let's go through some of these letters. First of all, Jack. Thanks, man. You're the first guy that's bought my lessons. I sent you a quick note thanking you for the purchase of my lessons, and then you sent me an email back saying, I actually heard about the lessons from your podcast, which I started to listen to last year, as I was interested in med sailing and have since bareboat chartered on the Amalfi Coast this summer. I purchased the lessons in support of your podcasting, but intend to listen to them regardless of the fact that I am ASA 104 certified. As your addition of real-world experience to the standard course material is always interesting to me, I would love to hear more technical details of real-world experience in your podcasts. I love the details on anchoring, boat repairs, sailing strategy, and such like that you include in your podcasts. All the best for both the podcast and the lessons. Best regards. Jack, thanks a lot. You're certified, you didn't need the lessons, and you just chose to support the podcast that way. Thanks a lot. And I hope you find the lessons worthwhile. I contacted Jack after this email, and I said, Jack, you sailed along the Amalfi Coast. Could I talk to you about your experiences? He said, yes. And we're trying to arrange a time to do an interview of him and his experience chartering on the Amalfi Coast. I've sailed on the Amalfi Coast myself, but it's been quite a few years. And we'll find out what his story is when he has a chance. So, Jack, I appreciate it. Along the same lines, in the interest of full disclosure, I sent a copy of the lessons to my nephew. My nephew, it turns out, became passionate about sailing several years ago, and I really didn't know about it. Totally independent of me. He may have known about my sailing, but he never really talked to me about it. So I took him and his friend sailing with me in one of the legs last summer, and he absolutely loved it. He learned a lot. He has a smaller McGregor sailboat. Not sure exactly the length, but it's a whole different type of boat. It's really a lake boat with a drop board or center board in it. And mine's a blue water boat, totally different type of boat. And he has this desire of doing maybe something along the lines of what I'm doing at some point in time in the future. So I thought, well, bring him out. Give him some real world experience. So I had him come out, and I told him, and here, this is what I always do to my guests. I invite one person, and I say, you bring a friend, because I like to meet new people, and that's a good way of meeting new people. So he brought his friend out, had a great trip. But I sent him my lessons, and I said, Mike, listen to my lessons. Tell me what you think. Give me some feedback. Now, he is my nephew. He's not going to say too much bad about me, but I'll read what he said. Franz, I just finished listening to your audio and have to say I thoroughly enjoyed it. I like the fact that you personalize lessons with real-world experience, even if some of it was at the expense of, and he puts his friend and I, like when his friend fell asleep at the wheel while he and I were down below. I felt like I was back in the Mediterranean with you again, listening to your experiences with crew members. It brought back a lot of great memories and education with my time sailing there this summer. You really do a good job putting a visual with the audio, and that's not easy to do. I listen to a lot of audio myself in the car, and if I don't feel engaged to a story or the narrator, I shut it off. I never felt bored or disengaged with your explanation of the course material, and I certainly was alert during the explanation of the section of when to whistle or blow the horn. My wife is like, what the heck are you listening to? That's just to say I had to turn the volume down during that section of the audio. In that section of the audio, I actually had whistle signals and explained what you were listening to. So there was the actual whistle signals, which I had in a wave file that I would put in with that particular lesson. All right, then he goes on to say, I think for someone to understand a lot of the sailing terms in the course, they should first have somewhat of a basic understanding of sailing, or at least look at the ASA course manual prior to listening to the audio, which is what I think the premise you have set up is the plan. The audio is a review and more life experience of what to expect when sailing and what will most likely be on the test according to your knowledge and experience. This is an audio I will go back to as a refresher often, as one can never know enough, and I'm doing my best to always learn where I can the art of sailing. Then he goes on to tell me what he's doing with his boat. Then the final paragraph. Anyway, I look forward to other audios you have put together to learn from. You really do a great job of narrating and sharing stories. Oh yeah, I followed your audio with the official manual of the basic keelboat sailing course and feel like you covered everything and then some with your audio course. Hope this feedback helps. If you have any questions for me listening to your audio, let me know. Thanks for the instruction, Mike. Mike, thanks. I know we're related, but I do appreciate your feedback. Okay, now, Dan, I talked a lot about your plans to sail across the Atlantic, and I told you to quit roller skating through the Louvre, and you titled your email back to me, Roller Skating Through the Louvre. You explained a lot of your situation, and this is a situation with Dan. He's sailed in the Mediterranean before. He's been sailing for a lot of years. He's certified, which you used to not have to be certified in America, but nowadays you do. He's sailed the Newport to Bermuda race. He had some knockdowns and some squalls. So he's not a neophyte. He knows what he's getting into. But he pointed out that he had already spent a lot of time traveling inland Spain and along the coast of Spain and agreed with me that marina hopping along the Costa del Sol and is it the Costa Blanca or the Costa Brava? I think it's the Costa Blanca is not particularly attractive to him, hence his quick run through Spain. Since he's already seen Spain and his wife has traveled to Portugal, they want to go straight to the Straits of Gibraltar and stop in Morocco along the way. Now, I never stopped in Morocco. I went straight through to Gibraltar. I was on the north end and waved at Morocco, and I forget the name of the town, just right across from the Spain on the African continent. But we didn't stop there. I didn't want to go through the headaches of clearing in and clearing out. And we were sort of in a hurry to get to Gibraltar, where I was going to install some roller furling on my force day. I sailed across the Atlantic without roller furling, and I think I mentioned in previous podcasts, I never wanted to go out on the end of that bowsprit again and get soaked, because every time I would go out and pull down the sail, I would get soaked. Even though I did have a downhaul on the sail, I could pull it down from the safety of the deck, but once it got down, I still had to go up and bundle it up and tie it up. So I was going to put roller furling on, and I did put roller furling on in Gibraltar. I've had Furlex roller furling gear ever since. It's never failed me once. It's great. It's a great investment from my point of view. My friend Jack had a hood roller furling, and in my opinion, it's a piece of trash. It's jammed twice. It's designed so that when birds sit at the top of the swivel, their excrement goes into the bearings and jams up the bearings. It's a bad design. Furlex, on the other hand, I've never had any trouble at all with my Furlex roller furling gear. And I put it up myself with the help of a couple Frenchmen on the docks. Had a sail maker recut my sail to put a bolt rope in it to fit in the track on the roller furling. And it's not the perfect sail because it wasn't designed for roller furling, but it does just fine. All right. So he gives me a little bit about his background. Said they're going to be leaving around May 5th. It's been 7 to 10 days working our way east through the Azores. So he's going to take, after my podcast, he said, I'm going to take 7 to 10 days in the Azores. Great idea. I love the Azores. I wish I had spent more time there. One of my big regrets in sailing across the Atlantic, because I doubt if I'll ever get back to the Azores again. They're volcanic islands, I think. Yes, they are volcanic islands. So they're very steep. So you only have a few harbors in the Azores. But the few that you can get to, take advantage of. And you might choose to leave your boat in Horta, which is a full-service marina. And, of course, you'll paint the name of your boat and do some serious artwork along the dock there, along the quay. And take a ferry to the other islands if you can't get there in your boat. Might be the most efficient way to do it. Rent a car. It's a really interesting place to visit. So they plan on spending some time there, some time in the Balearics. Thinking 2 weeks in the Balearics. I think you ought to add a week or two more in the Balearics. It's an overnight sail from the Balearics into the Straits of Bonifacio. Now, I don't know if you're going to stop on the east coast of Sardinia or not. I had intended to, but then I changed my mind and had a great wind, so I sailed straight through the Straits of Bonifacio, which is the straits between Sardinia and Corsica. One of my crew members, it was an early morning when we were arriving in the Straits of Bonifacio. The winds were really strong from our stern, so we were being blown downwind. And I got up, and he's a sailor. He knows what he's doing. He said, "Franz, I learned something about this boat I never wanted to learn." I said, "What's that, Mike?" And he said, "It surfs." My boat's not designed to surf. But we had following seas and following winds, and we were screaming through the Straits of Bonifacio. So we went straight through the Straits of Bonifacio, went up to the town of Bonifacio on the southern end of Corsica and spent a night or two there, and then headed on down to Sardinia. We spent, I think, 2 weeks. No. We spent at least a month sailing in Sardinia. Enjoyed it quite a bit. I didn't sail on the west side of Sardinia or on the south side of Sardinia. From Sardinia, we went straight over to Italy. But, and here's something I wanted to point out to you. It's about a day and a half sail from Sardinia, at least in my boat. Your boat may be a little faster, but in my boat it's about a day and a half, 2 days, really about 2 days. Yeah, it would really be 2 days. Two days to get to Italy from, at least to Ischia, that's where I was headed, from Sardinia. But along the way, sailed all day. I think we left at night. Yeah, I think we did. We left in the evening, sailed all night long. The next morning, I get up and I look around and there's some islands off to the northeast of me. And we're headed sort of close by these islands. Hadn't really even thought about stopping at any other islands. Didn't realize there were any other islands out there. Went down on my chart and we were going by the island of Ponza. We said, well, why don't we just stop in Ponza? So we did. And it's one of those islands that very few people ever visit. And we ended up spending about 4 days just wandering around Ponza. There's a town of Ponza, which was interesting. We anchored, took a dinghy ashore, and right where we tied up the dinghy, the raw sewage was coming into the harbor. That sort of turned us off on staying in this town, because I do like to swim. So we left the town and went around the north coast, and down on the north west side of the island of Ponza, there's a really well-protected harbor there, and we ended up spending 2 or 3 nights there before we continued on to Ischia. Sailed into Ischia, and that was pretty much the end of the summer that year for me. And that was a year, that was 2 months, where we left from Santa Pola, Spain, went through the Balearics, visited Sardinia, so I guess we spent about a month in Sardinia, and then continued on to Italy. So that was 2 months, just that part of the trip for us. Now, what I wanted to tell you was where I left my boat in Italy. And I actually printed off online, brought the notes with me. And this is a harbor, a boatyard that I heard about somewhere along the way. But we left the boat in Base Nautica Flavio Gioia in the town of Gaeta, G-A-E-T-A. Which is on the inside of the Bay of Naples on the northwest corner. And very few people ever visit Gaeta, but I fell in love with that town. That town is one of my favorite little Italian villages. And it's not really a village, it's really a city, but it's not a big city. It's a relatively small city. But I absolutely loved Gaeta, and the boatyard was top-notch. We were putting the boat up in August, and it was unbearably hot. I had a new crew that joined me in Sardinia and would sailed over. Dave and Scott, great crew members, they volunteered to help me put the boat away for the winter. And I had a lot of chores I needed to do on the boat, some repairs, some stuff. We spent about 4 days putting the boat up, and it was so unbearably hot. I understand the whole concept of siesta, because about 1 o'clock every day when we were working on the boat, we would all just basically find a place to sit in the shade and not even talk to each other, just sit there and wait for the temperature to drop. And around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe 6 o'clock in the afternoon, the temperature would drop enough we could get back working on the boat. But the temperature was unbearably hot. But I did love the town of Gaeta. It's about 2 hours south of Rome on the train. There's a stop on the train. You could actually go right from the, let's see, what did we do? We went from the train station in Rome to the main train station, no, from the train station at the airport to the main train station in Rome, switched trains, and then caught the train down to Gaeta, where the train lets you off is still about 5 miles away from the town. You have to catch a cab, get the rest of the way in there. It's the base of one of the American fleets. Is, I don't know if it's 6th Fleet or any, or what it is, but it's one of the U.S. naval fleets, has a base right in Gaeta. And when we were there, which we can't do anymore, I'm sure, we just took the boat and motored right through the middle of the fleet at anchor there. Just could come right up to the sterns of the boats, say hello to the crew that would be looking over at us, watching us, and continue on our way. I'm sure the security is a lot different now than it was then. You might consider that if you head straight to Malta. That's a long trip. That's a long trip. Still think you're biting off more than you should. But yeah, there's a couple choices for you. You could stay in Monel Island, Malta, if you decide to go that route. But you might want to stop in, if you're heading over to Ischia and Capri, you might want to stop at Gaeta. Like I say, I really enjoyed the town of Gaeta. We did a little bit of inland travel there, rented a car for a few days, but I just like the town of Gaeta. So, one more comment here, one more email, and this email was actually from last summer. By the way, I don't know if any of you have this problem, but when I've read emails, first of all, on my iPhone, and then gone to download it at my computer, sometimes I can't find the email. It disappears. Has anybody else had that problem? And you know, on my iPhone, I probably get 200-300 emails a day, 90% of which are junk. So, and the iPhone doesn't have a way of filtering out the junk mail, so for me to go find it again on my iPhone, theoretically I should be able to, but in reality it's very difficult. So I don't know if anybody else has had that problem or not, but if I read it on my iPhone, I may not even be able to download it on my computer. And if I am able to download it on my computer, I usually save it to a special file so I can go back and make comments like I am right now to emails. Oh, actually I have two more emails. Peter, 10-year-old kid. You asked for the elk butchering video. I sent you links to it, but I decided not to put it up on the website. I don't think an elk butchering video on Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast really makes much sense. But good luck on your elk hunt. Once you get the elk, the work has just begun. But the meat is great. I had some in my eggs this morning, and I had a roast last night. I had, I had beans from my garden, honey from my beehives in my coffee this morning, and tomatoes from our garden, and elk. I'm really not a granola guy, but I like this stuff. It's sort of fun. Well, and Peter, if you have comments, I sent you a copy of the series, the ASA 101 series. I'd like your comments when you get a chance. I'm working on the next course, the ASA 103. I'm 3 lessons into it. I'm not sure how many lessons it'll be, but I'm about 2 hours of instruction right now. I'm actually about an hour and a half of instruction right now on that one. Hopefully I'll have that done in a couple weeks and have that up and available. These will be available in iTunes and Amazon probably in about a month. Right now I'm working on the cover art that I need to upload. If any of you are really good with Illustrator and have some concepts you want to run by me, drop me an email with your ideas. Do it in a JPEG, and if I like them, I'm paying one guy right now for his ideas. I'm always open for other ideas. From JP, you and your wife live in Athens. You mentioned some other places I might have visited in the Sporades this summer. I'm not sure if I responded to this on air. I don't think I did. But he mentioned that there are some other islands in the Sporades I might want to visit. They have some local cuisine, goat cooked in clay pots. And he also mentions near Sporades is Skyros, not a very local island, less trampled. I went in and out of Skyros. That was my main port for picking up crew. I wouldn't do it again. Skyros is sort of out of the way, but the harbor, the port in Skyros was the best I've seen in Greece. Best services, a good harbor master, well protected, free electricity, free water, toilets. You don't see that in Greece very much. But it was quite a ways out of the way, and every time I'd have to go pick up a crew, it would take me literally a full day to get there and a full day to get back to the other island. So next year, if I go back, then I will probably use a different base for picking up and letting crew go. You said, I'd be curious how your son fared in Perth. We have a possibility of moving there in a few years, and friends, everywhere you look, there seems to be a marina. I absolutely love Perth. My son-in-law worked for Barrick Corporation in Perth as an industrial hygienist. He traveled all over Australia, New Guinea, and Africa as the industrial hygienist for the company. We went and spent a winter in Perth. And if there's one place in the world I wouldn't mind living, it would be Perth. I think you mentioned you're a physician. My friend actually places physicians in Perth for the hospitals there. So I love Perth. It's like stepping back 100 years in Southern California. It's got about the same climate as Southern California does, a Mediterranean climate. As you go north, it's like going south from San Diego into a desert, and as you go south, it's like going up into the redwood forest and the tingle tree forest. So I love Perth. I could easily live in Perth, but it's expensive. It's not a cheap place to stay. Australia is not cheap, and it's the farthest major city from anywhere else in the world. All right. That's my comments. That's a lot. So let's get on to the main topic of today's podcast. Since I've had comments that people like to know about the problems of dealing with the boat and technical questions, let me just go back and talk about the last episode where I talked about sailing to Paros. All right, let's go back and set the stage so you know where I'm coming from on this one. So now I'm walking again. I had to stop and read all these letters. So now I'm going to be walking down into Memory Grove. So my crew would join me in Kosh, K-A-S, and we'd sailed from Kosh. And Kosh is right next to Turkey. I'd actually sailed from Turkey over to Kosh by myself and cleared in customs in Kosh, which is one of my least favorite clear-in and clear-out harbors in all of Greece. They got a full-service marina there, though. It's a good full-service marina. It was a good place to pick my guests up. We sailed up and over, went by Amagoros and a few other islands, and I'm not in front of a chart, so I can't really tell you the names of the islands. But we ended up, well, let's see, we also stopped in Ios, and then I dropped them off in Santorini. As we were pulling in to Santorini, my auto helm, which used to actually be the brand auto helm, but now it's part of Raymarine, and since it's become part of Raymarine, the quality has deteriorated significantly. Anyway, my auto helm quit working. Maybe I should back up even farther. After I'd sailed across the Atlantic, my crew left me in Lagos, Portugal, and I had to get up to Sevilla to pick up my family. Well, there's a long haul between Lagos, Portugal, and Sevilla. So I thought, well, I'll get a good start. So after my crew left, I left Lagos Portugal and put the boat on autopilot. It was calm, started motoring. I hadn't gone a mile and my auto helm quit working. Just quit working. So I thought, Jesus, that's going to be a long, long night at the tiller if I can't figure something out. So I looked at the chart and I said, okay, well, let's pull into Porto Maio, which is this little village about, well, about 6, 7, 8 miles away from Lagos, just on up the coast. They had a good anchorage. So I pulled in, dropped my anchor, threw my dinghy in the water, rowed ashore, called my wife and said, call up West Marine, and when you come over, bring another auto helm with you. Of course, the one I had been quit being made. It was the Auto Helm 2000, which was a piston and a separate control module. And the piston was connected to the control module with a wire, the control module mounted wherever you want it to be mounted. Mine was in the cockpit. It had worked pretty well. I'd had to send it back to get repaired one time to Auto Helm, and they fixed it and sent it back. It was the control module that went out. So my wife says, well, they don't have that one anymore. Which one do you want? And I said, I told her which one to bring out. And this one was nowhere near as good. This one had the full tiller controls right on the piston. So instead of having two pieces, it's just one piece that you plug into the electricity. Well, okay. So after I'd called her and she went and ordered one and she was going to bring one out to Seville, I had several glasses of port because I was in Portugal and I bought some white port. I thought, well, what's the harm? So I opened it up. I decided, let's examine this and see what's in there. I've never really taken it apart before, but I thought, well, there's no downside at this point in time. So there were four little Phillips screwdrivers holding these two parts together on the electronic module. I shook it, and there was something rattling around inside of it, and I thought, well, let's see what I can do. So I opened it up, and there was a screw that was holding the flux gate compass inside the unit that had come undone. So I thought, well, I got some Loctite out, put the screw back into it, tested it out, worked just fine. And it continued to work just fine until several years later in Turkey, it quit working again. And I just happened to be near Göcek, and there was a electronic repair guy there advertised his abilities to fix electronic parts. I took it into him. I said, can you fix this? He said, sure. Took him a couple days, replaced a couple transistors, charged me $30 for it, and it worked just fine until I just was arriving in Santorini. Now, every now and then, if you have one of these units, every now and then it may start acting strangely. And what I've found is if you get heeled over really far, or if somebody turns the electronic control unit a certain way, sometimes a flux gate compass would get stuck. And I learned that just take it apart, knock it down, it would work just fine after that. But this time, we pulled into the marina in Santorini. Harvey and his wife left. I thought, well, okay, I've got to work on this. So I started taking it apart again, figuring I've got a week by myself, and I have no auto helm, and it's not fun. I don't enjoy sitting at the tiller all day long. So I took it apart, and I thought, well, it's going to be the flux gate compass. Well, it wasn't the flux gate compass. It took me a while to figure it out. But this little motor inside this unit had been working itself, well, for at least 10 years, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's running the pistons. Well, what had happened is the brushes on this tiny little motor, which is about an inch in diameter and about an inch and a half long, with just a little cog on the end, the brushes had finally worn themselves down to nothing. And I could make it work by pushing down where the brushes go, but there wasn't enough graphite to make contact with the armature and the motor. I thought, that's a tough fix. So I couldn't fix it, so I ended up hand steering, and I got the boat because I have a full keel boat. I've got the boat so with just different types of rigging with bungee cords and stuff, I could get it to sail itself for about 10 minutes. Then I'd have to, then the boat would come off course and I'd have to readjust it and reset everything. But I could almost get it to sail itself, even under motor, for about 10 minutes. And then I'd have to do something. Now, I like to read a book. I like to do other stuff. I do keep a watch, but I don't like to hold a tiller all day long. It took me one day after I launched the boat to figure that out. Pulling to Paros, and I told you the story about Paros and the people off the Sir Winston Churchill having me over for a drink and me renting a scooter, but I didn't tell you this. I thought, well, let's see if I can jury-rig a brush. So what I need to go do is find a auto electric shop and buy a brush. And so I started riding around the island looking for an auto electric shop, and I found one. I walked in, and of course they didn't speak English, and I just talked them into letting me walk back into their parts room, and I found some small brushes, graphite brushes that are used on the alternators. Bought a couple of them, took them back to the boat, and started trying to sculpture them into these tiny, tiny, probably 16th inch square brushes that would fit into this motor. And I worked in that and worked in that and worked in that, and I could not get it to work. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that auto helm that my wife brought over, that great Ray Marine auto helm, I've been carrying it around as a spare all those years just for this eventuality. And guess what? When I needed it, it didn't work. So I'm not a particular fan of Ray Marine. I brought it back along with my other auto helm back that year. Sent the Ray Marine auto helm up to get fixed. And they fixed me and charged me a lot for it. Of course, it was way out of warranty, but I'd never used it, but that didn't matter. It was a piece of crap auto helm. And I don't think much of Ray Marine. If you hadn't heard that by now, let me say it again. I don't think much of Ray Marine. As a general rule, I will not buy their products anymore, except I'm sort of forced to with auto helms because they have a monopoly on tiller auto helms. I wish somebody else would come out and build one. It's not rocket science. It's pretty straightforward. If you're an electrical engineer, I can tell you the motor. Okay, so I end up sailing the rest of that summer without an auto helm, and I bring both of these back. I send the new, unused Ray Marine auto helm, and it's the 2000 ST, the 2000 Sea-Talk, and it supposedly has all these new great bells and whistles that talk to your GPS and all these nice things that I don't really need, I don't really want. I just want to be able to set a course and let the boat steer itself. I don't want to have it steer to a waypoint. I can do that. I just wanted to steer a compass course. Sent it back, got it fixed. Then I start the search for a replacement motor on the original auto helm 2000. I search and search and search. I go to hobbyist shops, look at their motors, look at their motors. None of them come close to matching the specifications of the one I've got. I look at every small engine manufacturer's website I can. The search goes on, a year goes by, I'm still not finding it. And so the next summer I'm sailing with this piece of crap Ray Marine Tillermaster 2000 Sea-Talk ST. It does not have the power of the old one, will not steer my boat well. It has to be dead calm for it to steer my boat. It won't handle really any waves or wind at all, where the other 2000 would do just fine in most conditions until it got really windy. When it got really windy, guess what? I have a wind vane. I would just set the wind vane and steer relative to the wind at that point in time. Would not steer a real straight course, but it steered a good enough course so I didn't have to hold on to the tiller all the time. Anyway, well, at least a year goes by, and I've gone through one summer with this Raymarine auto helm, and I come across a Japanese small motor manufacturer, and I'm able to search by dimensions on a motor and voltage by a motor, and I'll be damned if it wasn't the exact motor that I had in my hand as I was looking at this. I get all excited. They have a manufacturer's distributor or a company representative, or maybe just part of the company, in Chicago. And I call this guy up as excited as can be. I said, let me order a motor. He said, well, how many do you want? I said, I'll take a couple. He said, well, our minimum order's 1,000 motors. They're only about $2 a piece. But our minimum order's 1,000 motors. I said, oh, jeez. I said, tell you what. And I explained the whole story and how, what a great little motor this was, and really played it up. And I said, is there any way that you can send me just a couple brushes to this, because then I can make my motor work? He says, okay, I can do that. So he throws a couple brushes in an envelope and sends them to me, and of course comes in through the mail and postal service, and running it through their machines, crush the graphite, and the brushes are useless. So I call him back again, and I said, geez, is there any way I can just get a sample motor? You know, then I can take the brushes out and put them into my motor, or just use the case and use my armature, because my armature has this little cog on it, and I hadn't figured out how I was going to get this cog off the shaft and put it on the new motor anyway. He said, well, all right. He sent me a couple motors, the samples, and that's what I did. I took the armature out of my old motor and put it into the new motor, put it into the piston, tested it out, and it's been working just wonderfully ever since. Now the piece of crap Raymarine auto helm is sitting in one of my berths for when this dies again, and of course we'll see if the Raymarine auto helm works when it's needed next time. Alright, I've been talking way too long. I didn't really talk much about sailing this time around. I do really enjoy the letters from people. It gives me something to talk about. You guys have a great day. Thanks for listening.